Are you recording?
This is Kathleen Holt, and I'm here with Roy G. Reed of Cimarron, Kansas, and we're going to be talking about his experiences in the service. The date is August 22nd, 2014. It's 11:20, and we are at the Cimarron City Library in Cimarron, Kansas. Roy, thank you for agreeing to do this. We're very happy to have your oral history as part of this series. Could you just kind of tell me, you mentioned that you were born, well, let's back up. Already I'm going to back up. Why don't you state your name and age and birth, I mean your name, birth date, and where you were born so that we'll have that for the record as well.
Okay. My name is Roy Reed, and I was born July 22nd, 1932, at Dighton, Kansas.
And then when did you go into the service? How did all that happen, and what was going on at the time that you joined the service?
Well, I graduated from high school in May of 1950, and the Korean War started in June of 1950. And I turned 18 in July of 1950, and in August of 1950, they zeroed in on 18-year-olds. So anybody that fit that category at that time, well, I said 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. The people that they started out sort of trying to get the people that World War II missed, but then they lowered the age a little bit.
What kind of was the average age of person going in at that time? Was it pretty much 18, 19? Huh. Was that true in World War II, do you know?
I don't think it was. In World War II, it probably started out sort of that way, but then they kept taking older people, I believe, in World War II.
So how did you talk to your parents about this? Did you decide what you were going to do, or did you have buddies that were interested? How did it transpire that you decided this was what you were going to do in August?
Well, I didn't really want to get into the ground war, so I was at sort of the top of the list for the draft, so I and a friend of mine enlisted in the Air Force. And they was, all the services were building up big, I had a pretty big build up at the time. So they sometimes, you had a month or two if you enlisted before they took you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you decided, where'd you sign up? In Dighton?
Dodge City.
Ah. Did you drive there? Did your parents take you?
No, we drove. I had room car then and everything.
Yeah? You were 18-year-old. Did 18-year-olds drive around like 18-year-olds do these days, or was it common to go as far as Dodge?
Oh, yes. I grew up actually 27 miles north of here.
Ah.
So that's an area where if you wanted to go anywhere, you had to drive.
Yes.
Because, that's...
You probably started driving when you were pretty young, huh?
Well, at 14, yes.
Yeah. That's where. Yeah. Did you have to drive into school? Where'd you go to school?
I went to country school through the sixth grade, and then the seventh grade. My mother, my older brother was a senior in high school. He was going to high school at Beeler, Kansas, so he moved up there, and I went 7th grade at Beeler, and then the 8th grade was back at the old Enterprise Country School.
Aha. Uh-huh. She moved so he could be a senior at Beeler?
Well, we just rented a house up there and stayed up there so we could go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And they was having problems at that time keeping those country schools going.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the last year. The only people in the school was my two sisters and me. So
wow.
Then that was the last.
Wow.
Last time they had school there, but they did move the school
huh.
down to south and west and consolidated it into a White Mountain School, they called it that.
Oh, oh. Huh. I was going to ask if it was still standing. So you go to Dodge, you sign up. Did you go to the Air Force office, or was it just a general recruiting?
The Air Force recruiter.
Yeah. Do you remember where was he in a...
Oh, it was downtown where the old post office was down there somewhere. I don't
uh-huh.
really remember. Dodge City has changed, as you well know.
Yeah.
Quite a lot in that,
yeah.
you know, period of time. In fact, they cut out a whole street on it, I think, there.
Yes, they did.
And
kind of right around that area.
Well, it was the post office was sort of up on the hill there,
uh-huh.
you know.
Uh-huh.
And seemed like quite a few recruiters had, you know,
yeah.
in the post office at
right.
that time.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you signed up, then what was the timeline?
Oh, I think I had about a month before we left to go to Texas for basic training.
Mm-hmm. But So let me ask you this, in that, did you have to take a test or anything at that point, or did you just sign up?
Well, earlier on you took a physical.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't recall whether you took a little test. I think maybe you did, and later on they give the old, after you was in there, they give you what they call the old Stanine test,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of to decide what they were going to do with you.
Ah, I see what area you'd go into. Did you flew, right?
Well, not at that time.
Oh, okay. So you sign up, you come back, and what happened in a month then? Did you drive to Texas or take the train?
No. I cut Milo, helped my uncle cut Milo. And that was November of 1950. It was probably one of the colder Novembers that, you know, at least I had experienced, or maybe it was just because I was out in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That after that, why, Texas didn't look too bad at all.
You were looking forward to that. So how'd you get to Texas?
Took the train out of Dodge
uh-huh.
to Kansas City and then train on down to Texas, and that was one of the things that in that time period they had trains going just about everywhere.
Yeah.
In fact, I think you could have gotten on a train at Cimarron here
mm-hmm.
and going to Daw, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Going to,
mm-hmm. San Antonio, is that where you were?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you this. Had you traveled a lot out of the area up to that point?
No.
Or was...
No.
Yeah. So what was Kansas City like?
Well, it was different for, I mean, I kind of hate to say this, but everybody, they had the physicals, and, well, everything, the physicals and everything was in Kansas City, Missouri, and that's where you stay
mm-hmm.
in an old hotel up there, and everybody went over to Kansas because they sold beer at 18 in Kansas
uh-huh.
and not Missouri, so.
That was part of the swearing in.
Yeah, well, yeah.
the physical. Was that pretty, how'd you feel like coming out of a rural area, and that was that quite a shocker experience?
No, not really. I thought it was just kind of normal for what went on.
Did people in your family serve in World War II, or did people talk about it?
Well, my older brother served in World War II.
Oh, okay.
Oldest brother.
So he probably had some experiences that you knew about.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And then I had cousins that served in this.
Uh-huh. So you went from Kansas City to El Paso. What was getting to El Paso like?
Well, San Antonio.
Oh, that's what I mean. What did I? I don't even know where I'm. Good thing it's your oral history. So San Antonio, and what happened then next? And where'd you stay? What was?
Well, there again, they was building up, and Lackland Air Force Base was. They had too many people there, so we stayed there about 10 days, I think, and then some people moved to Sampson Air Force Base in New York, which they'd opened up for basic training, and I moved to Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, which happened to be where my oldest brother took basic training during World War II. And Shepherd is at Wichita Falls, Texas, which really isn't that far from here. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So basic training, anything eventful about that? You kind of knew what to expect or what?
No, not really, but it was just, military thing, They would learn left from right. Sometimes they'd make you carry a rock in your left or your right hand.
Oh. I imagine growing up on a farm, you knew that, huh?
Well, it was still, it was easy. I didn't take band or anything like that, so marching was different for me.
Oh.
And some people... I was one of the people that had probably, that they yelled at a lot for making wrong moves.
Oh. But do you have any, most rotten memory of basic training?
Oh, not really. I do know that one of the sergeants there broke his leg in a touch football game, and everybody was happy about it. which you shouldn't be happy about someone breaking their leg.
Anything funny happened then? Pranks? Everybody?
No, not that I remember. It was a typical military deal where. That they, it started real early in the morning, and then instead of, later on they used mops and stuff, but in basic training they cleaned with scrub brushes and what I would call grandma's Lysol soap, it's the brown soap that people used to make. And they sometimes would make you use a toothbrush to clean stuff with, an old toothbrush.
So that was a big part of it, cleaning and doing the barracks and then...
Well, that was a part of it.
I don't
know if I could say it was a big part of it, but mm-hmm. It was... you went through obstacle courses, and it's what they do in basic training yet, I think.
Hmm.
When firing range and stuff like that, mm-hmm. basically.
So you learned how to take care of your weapons?
Yes.
So what happens at the end of basic training?
Well, at the end of basic training, I was assigned to go to radio school, which I really, radio maintenance school in Scottsfield, Illinois. So I did. They flew us or flew the ones going to Scott from Wichita Falls to Scottsfield in Illinois in a C-46 airplane, which that was different. Not like an airliner. It's, you know, it had side seats.
Did you have to get, like, strapped to the side?
No, they did have seat belts along there, but that was it.
So like that little bench seat that folds down?
Yes, it's a cargo airplane and had the just seats fold down off the side.
So how many people went with you to that? People from your unit went with you to that, or
well,
was it?
From all the units there, I think there was probably 10 or 12 people in the airplane was all.
So then where were you then, and how long, and what did you do then?
Well, I was at Scottsfield for radio school was 9 months, roughly, radio maintenance school. And from there, you got a 30-day leave, and then shipped over to Japan.
Wow.
There again, we went to Camp Stoneman, California, for processing to go overseas, which again happened to be where my oldest brother processed, which that everybody did. That was just a big processing center for Army and Air Force. And got on a ship called the USS Randall and went to Japan on it.
What were you thinking then? Would have been maybe about 19 by then?
Yes, I was 19 then. But the thing that I've never been seasick or air sick, which I guess that's, but a lot of people got seasick on it, and that was probably one of the worst things, it's really cramped on them. They stacked four high and real close together in bunks, but if people on top got sick, well, that's,
uh-oh.
Yeah, just, but then it started smelling, the ships, like them in holds. Started smelling quite a lot.
Oh.
And then we had a part of a typhoon and slowed it down going to Japan. It took quite a while to get there, a little longer than normal because of the typhoon.
Roy, what were you thinking? I mean, I just try to think. A kid who grew up in Kansas, landlocked Kansas, and then finds himself first flying around and then taking off on a ship for however long.
Well, I don't know. I just, at that age, though, you still don't think much about stuff. I think that's why probably the military likes younger people because they do, they kind of accept things as
How long did it take you to get to Japan?
I think it was like maybe 13 days, almost 2 weeks.
And then what did you think when you stepped off the...
One thing I did think was, my oldest brother was in China fighting the Japanese, and there it was. Was roughly 6 years later that I was, going into Japan. I was fighting the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that did go through my mind, said, hey, that what happened there, That,
mm-hmm.
That,
mm-hmm. That is remarkable. Where did you say? I thought I wrote it down, but I didn't. Where were you in Japan then?
Yokota Air Base. It's still there. Yokota. Just not really too far from Tokyo. It's pretty close to Tokyo.
Okay.
And I was there for, I think, people that were married, like I told you, that I was stationed with Harold Ott there.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh.
But I stayed there. I was there before he came a little bit. And then since he was already married to Virginia, he left, quicker than I did.
Did you know he was going there, or he just showed up one day?
No, I didn't know him at the time.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's just,
Was he from Kansas?
Well, he was from southeast Kansas, and I don't know how, but I think he'd been out here working or something.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow. Were there other people that you met during that process that were from Kansas, either that you knew or you met?
Well, there wasn't a station, a base that was close to mine. Was a person I went to school with, a friend of mine from school was stationed there. And so we was able to get together on occasion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did your parents and your family think about you signing up and going to Japan?
Well, I think they just kind of accepted that too, because that's what I know. I had a cousin that was killed in World War II, and he understood that was part of what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And people accepted the fact that it was probably necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was or not, I don't know. Really, they ended up with a truce, and I guess we're still at war with Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And just so happens I have a son that's in South Korea now. He's working as a company that is maintaining an airplane for an army.
Hmm. So were you ever in Korea, or what did you do when you were in Japan then? What was the...
Well, I was radio maintenance. I was in radio maintenance, and so I just... All the time I was there, I worked at a big transmitter station.
Mm-hmm.
Huge transmitters sent stuff back to the United States and other places.
Hmm. Did all of the communications from Korea go through Japan then?
Quite a bit of it, not all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Korea was like most of the bomb strike stuff went through either either Yokota there was two B-29 units flying missions over Korea. One was at Yokota, and the other was Okinawa.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Did you do support for the bombers, too? I mean, the radio?
Yes, was part of that. Part of it. And they occasionally, one of those would crash, coming in. It got shot up in Korea, but not often. So they didn't really lose a lot of them, but they did lose one occasionally.
So what was a typical day like for you? Where'd you live?
Well, we started out living an old Japanese World War II barracks, and they even had tents, but they were able not to be able to use them. But then later on, they built new barracks, which is pretty nice.
So, did you sleep in a dorm room with a bunch of guys, or did you have private rooms?
No, that was still close enough to World War II that they was all that they had big, people living in double bunks, all lined up. You've probably seen it on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how, people lived, and had what the military calls a latrine, which is a bathroom. They just had a big bathroom, with everybody. One big shower with several shower, had four or five or six shower heads in it.
Mm-hmm. Is that where that toothbrush came in handy?
Well,
for cleaning?
But that's one thing, that in Japan, we didn't have to do any cleaning.
Oh.
We hired Japanese to clean the barracks up and everything.
Huh. Who cooked?
Well, they still had the mess hall.
They
had big mess halls that they, on World War II type deal, where they, served several hundred people in them.
What kind of food? Western food or?
No, it was, I never did. A lot of people dislike that food, but I thought it was always pretty good. They served mostly, those big mess halls served mostly scrambled eggs.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, there's not much of a choice of eggs. And then overseas, you got quite a few dried eggs, and then the milk over there was all recombined, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
Milk powder. And they always had C and K rations. If you didn't like the food there, you could eat them.
Did you have much fresh produce and stuff like that, or?
Oh, not a lot there, because of the Oriental system of agriculture. They didn't really use much fresh produce.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh, wait a minute. There we go.
Throughout the Orient, they used human waste, mm-hmm. and any other kind of waste as fertilizer for their vegetable crops and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a chance that you can pick up some bugs that are not conducive to happiness.
So then you had, after breakfast, what'd you do?
Well, I worked shift work all the time, so it was not, you didn't eat. It wasn't like the farm out there where you got up certain times. And I worked, worked whenever they signed you to work, whether because they run it 24 hours a day.
Wow. And then were you, like, repairing equipment or monitoring? Or
repairing and monitoring both.
Okay. So you might have to go to different parts of the base?
No, it was all one.
In a shop?
Way off, the sandbag building on the outskirts of the base.
Huh. So you just went to the same place and they brought the equipment in? Huh. Okay, so at work, were there security issues, or were cryptographers in the same building, or they were someplace
else?
No,
they were someplace else. Uh-huh. And this is what they scattered the communications all throughout the base, with the transmitter section being on one side of the base and the receiver section on the other side.
Oh. So what happened after work?
Well, they do read, do whatever you want to do. You go to town, in Japanese towns around.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Well, it's typical kind of Oriental towns that they had bars and places like that,
So you're not going to tell us your bar stories?
Well, I probably ought to leave that out.
Oh, I see. You don't want to get that down on paper. So you weren't ever under attack, but it sounds like you had sandbag safety things.
Yes. It was, it's just the way they done that, that they did have some people that was against, the United States being into conflict with the Koreans and the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the Japanese. They handled all that.
Was there resentment of the Americans there, but from on the part of the Japanese, since it was so soon after the war?
I never really. There probably was, but they kept it to themselves. I'm sure there was resentment. I don't see how there couldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Was the area you were in rural, or was it like just another town? Or you said close to Tokyo.
It's close to Tokyo. And
yeah.
That's anything close to Tokyo is not completely rural,
mm-hmm.
even though it has farms. I mean, it's pretty heavily populated.
How did you get around there?
Trains. Or bicycles, even.
Oh, yeah.
Buy bicycles and ride around.
Huh. Did you bring anything home from that? Any souvenirs and send anything home, anything like that?
Well, I was able to send dishes. Most people did send dishes. And that was probably the main thing that people sent home from.
Mm-hmm.
Japan was dishes, and sometimes some of their other little trinket things
mm-hmm.
the Japanese built.
What'd your mom think while you were there? How'd you communicate with your family?
Just by letter.
Uh-huh.
I don't think she was terribly bothered by it. She'd already, there again, that's kind of figured that that was the way it was.
Mm-hmm. Did you get letters from home?
Yes.
Get care packages?
Not often, maybe occasionally. A lot of things was at that time was like the same cookies, they was pretty well crunched up by the time they got there.
What about celebrating holidays?
There again, the military basically is not, at least the part I, you know, is not a, they're not holiday oriented. Mm-hmm. Although they do give, you know, time off for Christmas and stuff like that. But they still run it, you know. They run it during, you know, 24/7 basically is what mm-hmm. what they, some of that is.
When you look back on that time, how do you feel about it?
Well, I enjoyed it. I really did kind of. I didn't mind it at all.
Mm-hmm. Have you been back to Japan since then?
Yes, I've been back, you know, several times. In fact, I left Japan in 1954. And then it was a little over 10 years later before I got back, and I opened the left window up on the airplane, and you could tell you was in Japan, you know, because of that using human waste and to mm-hmm. to fertilize mm-hmm. to be, you know, I guess the closest thing you could say it smelled like an old outdoor John, basically, the countryside did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's true of a lot of the Orient, that mm-hmm. they did that.
What did you go back to the base or just go back to visit Japan?
No, I later on I was flying in and out of Japan.
Oh, okay.
Go to Southeast Asia.
Uh-huh. Huh. So this was kind of like a phase of your life that was like maybe the introductory level, would you say?
Well, I didn't consider it that. I just, you know, it was just a, went, you know, I did get out and went to JUCO and then applied for aviation cadets and was accepted and
mm-hmm.
was able to get through flying school without getting washed out.
So in 54, the conflict was over.
Well, the truce was signed.
Oh, yeah.
In 53.
Okay. And then did your higher up come to you and say, sign up again, or you're out, you're ready to go home? Or?
No, they could have. I could have re-enlisted again, but they was, you know, that after every war, they built up, and then try to, you know, then kind of go back down, except they didn't. In actuality, we'd have had a lot more problems in the Korean War had it not been for World War II mm-hmm. and having all kinds of equipment mm-hmm. over there. Because when the United States was, peace had arrived and at the end of World War II and they didn't really have that much stuff to fight with, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have that many people in the service. That's why they recalled people and tried to build up real quick. I know, like B-29s, most of them had been you know, stored in Arizona, and they had to, they got a lot of them, a lot of airplanes out of storage, and a lot of, and then they had factories in Japan that refurbished tanks, trucks, jeeps, all kinds of stuff like that, that they had stashed around in either Japan or on some of the Pacific islands. They hadn't got around to dumping into the ocean yet.
Wow. So 54, you came back home, or did you move straight to Dodge?
No, I still had spent like 6 months in the service after I came back from Japan at Altus Air Force Base in Oklahoma, which is just south of Dodge, you know. And then I got out and enrolled in college and spent 2 years at the community college at Dodge. And 1 year at Emporia, and then and I went into aviation cadets.
And how'd that happen?
Well, I was just, you know, took some tests, and I was qualified, you know, for it. And
what made you want to fly?
Well, I always kind of wanted to fly. And in fact, I flew some. My brother, oldest brother, had an airplane when I was a kid, you know, high school. So I'd flown in it, and I'd took lessons in it for Dodge. So I'd flown some back when I was a teenager.
Was that very common?
What?
To fly or have a brother who had a plane?
Well, I don't know. For the Cal Vista area up there, for some reason they had, you know, in fact, Garden City and Dodge City airports kind of made fun of it. They call it Cal Vista Air Force.
Oh.
There's several planes up there, you know, that time. They later on, the bankers clearly got, but they were good, you know, for checking cattle. They're really nice.
Oh. Huh. That's interesting that something that would be practical to check cattle might turn into a career for you.
Well, I didn't do the checking, but they used it. He used it to go out and, which is, you still need to, all you can kind of see from there is that they're there. You can't tell if they're sick or anything.
Oh,
so you
sure.
still need to either go ride a horse out there and look at them or, or
get a,
take a vehicle out and look at them or something.
So you spent a couple years. How'd you pick Emporia?
My sister went to Emporia.
Ah.
So I thought I'd, you know.
Did you have a goal in mind?
Well, I started out, I was going to be an engineer, and then I went into teaching, and that's why I didn't know if I wanted to be a teacher or not. I ended up getting license to teach science and math. Never did do much of it, but I had a license for it.
I hear they're looking for a math teacher.
Well...
Is it too late, Roy?
Yeah, they don't want me.
Okay, so let's kind of move forward into that area then. When you got into the cadets, you stayed at Emporia, and then you were in the air cadets there?
No. I went there again. The deal they had, you had pre-flight. I went pre-flight back at Lackland.
Okay.
And then through primary flying school in Hondo, Texas, which is out to the west of San Antonio, about 50, 60 miles west of that. And then basic flying training was at Reese Air Force Base at Lubbock, Texas.
Oh.
Which Reese is now closed. But that's, I was telling you to regress back a little bit. The ship that I came back from Japan on was the same ship my oldest brother went overseas on in 1943.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. You just practically followed in his footsteps, didn't you?
But it also was one that they had a raid on a prisoner of war camp that they got in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And they put them prisoners on the USS Anderson, was the name of the ship, and brought them back. So, you know.
Wow.
I was able to see that on the, you know, show that on the TV, sometimes.
Oh,
that ship was the same one I was on for, well, it was probably 10 days. It's a little closer. Coming back was quicker than going over. So.
Do you keep in touch with any of those people that you knew in that from Japan, Yokota?
Well, no, just Harold Ott was all. I kind of kept in touch with him. Otherwise, well, I don't, you know. I do keep in touch with some of the people I was in the bomb wings with. And in flying school, we have, you know, reunions. So I am in touch with some of them.
So if you fast forward to Lubbock, then what happened after Lubbock? Any adventures in your flight training?
Oh, it was just, you know, that's kind of a tough course. They washed out about half the people, or over half the people that started it. But after I was commissioned as a second lieutenant and assigned to the 310th bomb wing at Schilling up at Salina as a KC-97 co-pilot. I spent 3 years there, and then went to KC-135s, which is a new airplane at the time, at Blytheville Air Force Base, Arkansas. Spent 4 years there. And then went to C-141s. Excuse me. C-141s at Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. From there to Libya until he got kicked out of there. So and I was supposed to come back to the United States, but I got a in-country Vietnam assignment.
Wow. What year was that?
1969.
So you went from Libya to Vietnam?
Yes.
Goodness. Were you married?
Yes, over there. My wife was... We were supposed to be accompanied over there, but they were having, you know, trouble with the Arabs at that time there. So she was delayed for like several months. And they wouldn't let anybody live off base anymore, which they did before. And they brought in a bunch of trailers from Algeria or somewhere from a base over there. small trailers and set them up, and that's what I lived in, which was right on the Mediterranean Sea. I could throw a rock into it from my trailer.
Wow. Now, how was that different from Japan?
Well, that's a completely different country. There's no doubt about that. You know, Japan is kind of wet and humid to a point, and Libya is about the most severe desert there is in parts of it. But I started out, and when we got to Libya, I was supposed to fly the base flight C-54, which was General Douglas MacArthur's old airplane. Nice, you know. Hopefully somebody put it in a museum somewhere, but they probably didn't. And then they run short of seaplane pilots, so I got to fly seaplanes for a while.
Oh. I have to say, that just amazes me, that landlocked people would end up flying seaplanes.
Well, that's it. I didn't have much choice in it. I didn't really want to do that one, but they said, you do it. And I hadn't been kind of scared for a long time in an airplane. That airplane's kind of hardest landing. Seaplane landings are hard. They're not like landing on land.
What's hard about it? I mean, just controlling that large...
No, just when... Actually, you think water would have a lot of give, but it doesn't. You see, the airplanes have oleo struts and stuff like that that kind of lets them... Where a seaplane goes, you know, or it stops when it hits the water. When it comes down, it hits the water. Why?
Rather abruptly.
Rather abruptly, yes. You think of water being soft, but at a certain speed, it's not.
How did you learn to do it?
Well, it's just, you know, when you fly airplanes, you're expected to be able to fly about anything that they give you or sign you to.
Did you ever fly as a hobby then?
Oh, not much. My wife didn't like to fly, so she, you know, that kind of... But our son, when he started flying, well, she would fly with him, but she didn't really... like to fly with me. She thought I was dangerous. So.
It was those seaplane landings. Let me ask you this. When you were in all these different places, were there sights that you took in while you were there or things that you saw that you remember specifically?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, one thing about flying big jet airplanes, you get to go to a lot of places, I think. Landed airplanes in like 36 countries. And you know, it doesn't really take a long time to get there. Like, like one time it took, you know, well, the old KC-97 was a propeller driven airplane. And it took a long time to get, but it was fairly fast for a propeller-driven airplane. But the jet airplanes flew twice as fast. So. And, you know, one of the things I tell people, you know, that, see, we used to go to Spain from Blytheville, Arkansas, and it's closer to fly up over Greenland than it is to fly straight east to Spain. We're about on the same latitude.
Wow. What's the most memorable moment you've had in an airplane?
Well, I don't know. I've had some of those kind of, you know, the KC-97 tended to lose engines every once in a while. That was kind of certain times. You kind of wondered if the airplane was going to be able to stay airborne or not. You know.
Wow. Did you ever have to do an emergency landing?
Well, yeah, we've done quite a few emergency landings at some old Boeing for a long time had cranked down gears, you know, on their propeller-driven airplanes. And the co-pilot got to crank the right main gear down. It took 105 turns on a crank to get it cranked down the right gear. Right, man.
Did you see your life flash before you?
No, I never really did.
You just figured it'd get there.
Yeah.
It's mechanical. Did you have a favorite? I mean, when you look back on it, a favorite base that you?
Well, yeah, overall, I liked the KC-135, and I liked the base it was on, which was the old 97th Bomb Wing, which had quite a history to it.
Where was that?
Well, it was at Blytheville, Arkansas at the time. Mm-hmm. Had B-52Gs and KC-135s, which the old, I mean, I hate to be political, but February they just got done chopping up all the B-52Gs, through their salt thing. And I think that maybe that was a mistake to do that.
Hmm. Just part of the arms reduction, is that what
yes.
it is?
Uh-huh.
Hmm. So I thought they just warehoused them, but they just chop them up? Actually?
No, under those treaties, they have a big axe thing that actually chops them up. And the problem is the United States is doing that, and Russia, they don't have some trouble. They're supposed to chop a bunch of their bombers up, but they didn't do it. They, as far as I know, they disassembled them, and then now they're putting them back together again. That's what I'm saying. It's probably not a...
Huh.
But all those airplanes are... KC-135s, which they can have at McConnell, mm-hmm. and that's probably some of them that I've flown. But they're a really old airplane, and so is the B-52s.
Mm-hmm. So what did you, then how did you get from Libya to fly to Vietnam?
Well, yeah, we took, they chartered airplanes they had. And mm-hmm. We went back from Libya, which that's, those charters then, they had the airplane had a lot of room, you know, with the seats wide. Mm-hmm. And we went from Libya to Rhein Main in Germany. And they put a bunch more seats in it and got it, you know, put them real close together like you fly now, mm-hmm. you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of packed in like sardines. And then I had about a month's leave or something, and went to San Francisco, and then I had to go. I went. They sent me through Jungle Survival School before Vietnam, so I went to Philippine Islands There's something that was interesting to me. I talked to my granddaughter about it. She knew about it, sort of, which is kind of strange. That where the survival school was in Philippine Islands, they had these little Aborigines people out there that are I didn't know that they didn't live in villages or nothing. They just, lived out there in the jungle.
Really?
Yes.
They were there when you were there? Encountered them in the jungle?
Well, they actually, what they done, they paid them in rice if they caught you.
Oh.
That was supposed to be part of the survival and then escape and evasion courses.
Uh-huh. Did they catch you?
Well, no, they never did catch me, but they caught a lot of people, and then a lot of people just, when they, toward the end, they just gave them some shit, so I probably should have done that. Those little white aluminum deals, and then a red one if you got in trouble out there where they could get help for you.
Oh. What was it like when you came back here? Was it different? How were you treated? What was it?
Well, I didn't particularly. I never go back to San Francisco again.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had all those people out there spitting and yelling, all the hippies.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
That again was 1969.
Mm-hmm. What made you pick San Francisco?
Well, that's just where they came into.
Oh, I see. That's where they took
it. It's commercial. They
I
hire,
see.
You know.
I thought maybe you went there on R&R or something.
Oh, no. I didn't. But I always liked San Francisco, but I, mm-hmm. That was a different deal.
Did you encounter a lot of that during that time?
Well, the only place I ever encountered it was in San Francisco.
Hmm.
But a lot of places they was mad at the war, and they kind of blamed the people who was in it for.
So 69, you went from San Francisco to where?
I got out in 1969 again.
Okay. Well, when were you in Vietnam?
1969.
Oh, so you went there and then to then
yeah, after out. Vietnam, I was just released from active duty, they called it.
Mm-hmm. Well, where were you in Vietnam? And when that was in 69?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
In 68 was when I went through survival school.
Mm-hmm.
But I only spent like 9 months in Vietnam. And I was mostly I was assigned to what was operating location one, they called it the Joint Search and Rescue Center.
Uh-huh.
And this was a place they called Monkey Mountain, which is north of Da Nang. Vietnam.
So is that what you did? Search and rescue?
Yes. I didn't actually do it. I just, called on radios and stuff for other people to do it.
Mm-hmm. Did you do any radio repair and stuff like
no,
that
no,
too?
No,
or you
no.
were solely?
That was after. When I never done that again after I got, except I kind of fooled with, radios and TVs a little bit on my own, but.
Yeah. Huh. So you came out in 69 from Vietnam, went to San Francisco, then where?
I got released from active duty. Went back to Emporia, went to school.
Okay.
And then went to the Air Guard at Topeka as a base operations officer.
Hmm.
That's where I then went back to flying old airplanes again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, oh, but they were pretty nice. In fact, some of them were really excellent airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, in 1973, I got an assignment to Air Command and Staff College at Montgomery, Alabama, which is a nice, you know, kind of a, it's a general wannabe school, is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, for a year, that's pretty nice.
What was your rank then?
Major.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that's changed is that, say, I was able to fly two new airplanes, high-dollar airplanes, actually. And now then, nobody hardly gets to, I mean, they don't hardly build any new airplanes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which the old KC-135 with I flew is still flying. Probably will be for another 15 or 20 years.
Wow.
Which makes it possible for getting down to the point to where people that flew them originally, their great-grandchildren could be flying them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. So your whole service career really did have an influence all the way across your life.
Well, it did.
Uh-huh. So is your son in the service?
No, he works for a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
He spent, I think, 10 years in the Army.
Mm.
Well, 4 in the Army and 6 in the Army Guard here at Dodge.
Mm-hmm. What's your takeaway? When you look back on it, how do you feel about that whole period of your life?
Well, I thought I was doing some, you know, great things a little bit, you know. I mean, kind of, but I kind of wonder if it was worth it or not, any of it.
In terms of what?
Well, in the terms of the way things are going at this time, maybe I'm just pessimistic, but it doesn't look like that nothing ever got solved, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly if you look Korea, Japan, well, maybe not Japan, Korea, Vietnam, Libya.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I probably would end up, you know, I met Gaddafi a couple of times, so I might be the only person in Southwest Kansas and, mm-hmm, ever met him.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. If you had to sum it up, what do you think was your most profound understanding, viewpoint, lesson from all that?
Well, I think probably is that things change rather rapidly. Hopefully for the better, but sometimes for the worse. And people that, you know, the country needs to be aware of that, I think, if they could.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now then there's a lot of political correctness, and you're not supposed to say things, and I'm not into political correctness. And I can and will say it, that the Middle East is going to be a big problem for this country.
Mm-hmm.
If mean, that's, the United States has always been kind of on a negotiation thing, but in my opinion, that's part of the country I've been in. Those people do not, they're not interested in negotiating. Mm-hmm. So, what does that leave you?
Do you participate in any veterans groups or things like that anymore?
Well, I belong to the American Legion. Right? Mm-hmm. I, after Vietnam, I quit all of it. You know, I didn't have any. Okay. I was mad at the American Legion and VFW, too. So.
Was that come back from there difficult to back when you got back to Kansas?
Well, it... There was, going to school was probably one of the, but it probably was different then. I mean, there was a lot of people that, but if you had took a class, I had a good advisor there. And they said, just pull you right out of the class. If you figured out because of being a Vietnam veteran, they was going to flunk you, and some would, you know.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Huh. But the advisor kind of watched that?
Yes. They had two very good advisors at that school. One of them was head of the science department, had been there for a year. Pretty well, a person by the name of Dr. Cram. Then I went into the business school there, and Eddie, it was good too. So,
What degree did you end up with?
Well, I got a, you know, bachelor of science and education, and then I never did. I was working on MBA when I got that assignment to Command and Staff College.
What'd you do after that?
After Command and Staff, well, I lived in Topeka. Mm-hmm. Lived in Topeka for 3 years, I guess. Then moved to Garden City.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do in Garden City?
I farmed some and substitute taught, and then taught school for a while. Mm-hmm. My wife, she always taught, you know, I mean, she got a master's degree in spatial education, so mm-hmm. It was, you know, she could get a job really easy, you know, anywhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I could do, but I wasn't a teacher so much.
Mm-hmm. When did you move to Cimarron?
1999, I think.
So you retired then, kind of?
Well, yes, I was retired out of the military when we moved.
Now, you mentioned SAC, Strategic Air Command. Did you say you were in that for a bit?
7 years.
Oh, I missed that part. Was that out of Topeka, though?
No, this was... Shelling was... Strategic Air Command base, and so was Blytheville, Arkansas.
Huh. Did you fly one of the SAC planes then?
Yes. That's,
now, tell us about that a little bit. I think I know a little bit because I think my father-in-law was a SAC pilot, too.
Well, SAC was a... One thing that was different, you know, they... Other commands, a lot of them, like, put your name in the paper. SAC didn't want your name anywhere.
Right.
They wanted, you know, just... If you started getting local paper, even, they didn't want anything publicized, which may or may not be good. I don't know. That's open to debate. But they had to, you know, SAC kept things later. You know, recently they've had problems with, like, not taking care of nuclear weapons and stuff. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen under SAC.
Now, what was it? What was the purpose of it?
Well, SAC was, at one time, had all the nuclear weapons. And then later on, the Navy got the nuclear submarines with nuclear weapons on them. Mm-hmm. But for years and years, SAC was the only one that had charge of nuclear weapons.
So did they send people down to those silos? Or the missiles, were those the strategic...
Yeah, that's...
Missiles,
so you went... Strategic Air Command, part of it.
Did you... Was that your job?
No, I was a pilot, so I didn't... Uh-huh.
Didn't they fly continuously?
Yes, at times.
Uh-huh. So I understood there was like a Strategic Air Command plane in the air all the time. So one took off.
There were several of them, yeah.
Yeah.
See, that's right at Blytheville. I got on some of those missions. It was 24 hours and 30 minutes long.
Really?
That's a long time to be in an airplane.
I guess. That seems like that'd be dangerous. Fall asleep and...
Yeah.
How many years did they do that? Do you know?
Well, I don't. The airborne alert started probably about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's one thing. In the KC-135 book, they used to give out. You know, SAC used to give out letters of commendation. They called them, and see, my crew was the first KC-135's crew to make the turn inside Diamond Head. We got a letter of commendation for that.
Wow.
There's noise abatement, which that's it really is not a thing the airplane would do it. But to take a 150-ton airplane off and make a turn with it right after it gets off the ground, that's
pretty good feat, huh?
Yeah.
Wonder if it was all that seaplane experience.
No, that was before the seaplane. But, But it's just they said it could be done, and then during the Cuban Missile Crisis, they did refuel a RB-47 about 12 miles off the coast of Cuba.
Wow.
Didn't say it's kind of a fun mission.
Kind of fun.
Well, I mean, but I, yeah. You know, it was just something that they didn't do all the time. It's different.
Mm-hmm. Did you know before those missions you were going to be doing them? Like, did they say next week we could have a mission, or was it like go now?
Well, some of them is go now, and others is planned, but. You know, in SAC, what SAC people do, they spend a lot of time on alert. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, mm-hmm. About half your time is spent on alert.
And that's, then what? What are you doing when you're on alert?
Well, they get all the airplanes off in 15 minutes. That was their deal. The
wow.
ones that was on alert.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's kind of a fun thing in flying is when they had like what they called a MITO, or MITO, minimum interval takeoffs. Uh-huh. When they run all them airplanes off at one time, that's uh-huh. that's a different deal.
What year range was this?
Well, I was in Blytheville from from 62 to 66. Mm-hmm. 1962, 66.
Did you do refueling? In air refueling?
Yes. Uh-huh. And then I was, they picked you then to fly third pilot on what they called the Chrome Dome mission. It was that 24-hour airborne mission. Mm-hmm. And I had a southern and a northern. And I was on the southern one, but went from the United States to cross the Mediterranean. And that's what they had KC-135s at both Madrid, Torrejon, and Madrid and Seville, Morón and Seville, Spain. Refuel the B-52s, and then they would go, I don't know, back up over in the Mediterranean in orbit for, but a B-52 was one of the reasons they were a problem. They had a lot of range, and they could penetrate like Russia. They went to war for many. Not anywhere they want to do, which mm-hmm. presents a problem for the other little, we refueled quite a bit because we had high-speed booms on our airplane, and some of them didn't, some tanker squadrons didn't. It was the B-58s. One of the things that was their problem was that they were corridor limited, so to speak. They couldn't.
So these are the ones they just chopped up?
No, this was B-58, was a supersonic.
Oh, okay.
It was a supersonic bomber.
Okay.
No, these were the B-52Gs, was what they had at Blytheville, and they lost two of them during when they were bombing Vietnam.
Did you see combat in Vietnam, or the remnants of combat with the rescue missions?
Well, Vietnam was, to a point, combat everywhere. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things with Vietnam. He was never, probably in a lot of cases, he wasn't in that much danger, but he was never safe. And all these wars in the Mideast are the same way. Mm-hmm. There's no safe spot when you're, mm-hmm. which is a little bit of a, it wears on people mm-hmm. when you have to be careful and aware of what's going on around you all the time.
Mm-hmm. Anything we haven't talked about?
No, I think I've talked, about everything.
Well, I sure have enjoyed it. I thank you very much. It's going to be a good interview, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Hey, one thing I might, talk about was during Jungle Survival School, mm-hmm. when they had all the snakes on exhibit that was in Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. and they had a little Philippine cobra, and every time they walked by, he popped the glass, mm-hmm. And I was out there, and it's kind of some grass, and trying to get some sleep, and it was silent, sometimes. And I could hear a mouse or something over there. And pretty soon it went, eek. And come and run, jumped across me, run right across me. So I was laying there and said, well, what the heck is it over there, you know?
Oh, no. Did it try to eat you?
No, no. But I was thinking about that little Philippine cobra that was...
Yeah.
He didn't like people, so...
Uh-huh.
So he was, you know, trying to pop every person that walked by.
Oh, my gosh. Did you have to learn to eat snakes?
Oh, we ate some snakes there again in flying school. They had a little survival school in Texas. Mm-hmm. And then, see, this is... Okay. I'm not a... They tell you, like, in survival school, not to wait, you know, to start eating that stuff. Supposedly, with few exceptions, you know, other than carrion and stuff like that, you can eat about anything that any other animal can eat. Mm-hmm. Which gets into some stuff, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you can't eat bugs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you?
No, I never did do it because I didn't. I figured if I had to, I would.
Yeah.
But they say, you know, don't wait till you get starved down before you start eating stuff like that.
Hmm. Are you an adventuresome eater?
Oh, no, I don't. I like about any food. That's kind of amazing. That, in fact, in one of the psychology class or something took in college, they asked about different foods and ended up about me and one other person was the only person that had her hands up. Now, they're just talking about, cabbage, you know, the things that people eat. There's a lot of people are kind of picky eaters on some things.
Mm-hmm.
And I never was, you know. I mean, it's just... Well, I guess for one thing, my parents wouldn't let us be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They just made you eat what they put on the table.
Cooked turnips.
Yeah.
Cooked carrots. I didn't like them. But I love them now.
That's
kind of crazy to...
Yeah.
I like raw carrots, but not cooked carrots.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah, parents have a lot to do with that, I think. Spell that. Is it Kyoto or Yokota, the Air Force Base in Tokyo, for me again?
Yokota.
Yokota. Okay, I wrote it down. I wrote Kyoto. Okay, I got it. Good. Anything else?
Well, that's it. That's...
Well, thank you, Roy. Okay, Kathleen Holt with Roy Reed, and we are at the Cimarron City Library on August 22nd, 2014.